Lecture 14, Three Grand Inquisitors, Dostoevsky, Kafka, Hess.
In this lecture, I'd like to discuss three literary figures who fit quite well into the sensibilities that we've been discussing. They are the Russian author Dostoevsky, the Czech author Kafka, and the Swiss author Hermann Hesse. Dostoevsky shares with Kierkegaard a very powerful religious sensibility. At the same time, he shares with Kierkegaard the view that being a Christian is by no means easy and not necessarily a happy state of affairs. Rather, being a Christian, having faith, requires going through the dark night of the soul and being steeped in doubt. He also shares a number of themes with Nietzsche, and as you'll see, there's some of the harder aspects of Nietzsche's philosophy that come out in some of Dostoevsky's most brutal novels. They didn't know each other, although Nietzsche was vaguely familiar with Dostoevsky's work towards the end of his life. And we'll see, too, that Dostoevsky anticipates some central themes in Heidegger's philosophy. I'd like to talk about a couple of Dostoevsky's works, most importantly, perhaps, Brothers Karamazov. But let me start by talking about a novelette that he wrote called Notes from Underground. In that novelette, he introduces us with a really unlikable character who describes himself in the first paragraph as a mean man, a spiteful man. And indeed, spite and resentment characterizes almost everything that he does. We're told right away that he's suffering from disease of the liver, and to the suggestion that he ought to see a doctor, his response is, "Let it get worse." One can interpret the novel in various different ways, but certainly the central theme is the theme of freedom and what other philosophers would call free will. He is attacking the Enlightenment and with it the idea that people can improve themselves, a thesis that goes back to Nietzsche. And he's attacking the idea that people can, in fact, have free choice in such a way that it leads to happiness. Now, this is an assumption that we often make, certainly in this country especially. The idea is that freedom and happiness go hand in hand, and unfreedom and unhappiness go hand in hand. What Dostoevsky shows us here is that the two are, in fact, opposed. That happiness is very often, precisely, the absence of freedom. In his notes, as in his other novels, Dostoevsky launches a vigorous attack on the whole Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, among other things, portrayed the idea of rationality and freedom in such a way that we could figure it all out, that we could construct for ourselves the perfect society in which we'd all be happy. It was represented, perhaps, by some of the festivals and some of the enterprises of the time, in which philosophers, even in Russia, were starting to talk about the promises of the future and how everything could be put right. What gets left out, according to this character, is our personal freedom. He says, for example, with reference to the whole Enlightenment mode of thought and the whole idea of reason, 2 + 2 = 4, as if that's what it's all about. His idea is that what is most important to us, what he calls our most advantageous advantage, is in fact our own free will. But insofar as we fit in with the rational schema, insofar as we go along with the plans that this Enlightenment society gives to us to make us happy, what we lose, no matter how happy we become, is our freedom. So being spiteful is not just a personality disorder for this character. Being spiteful is a philosophical principle, because insofar as one is spiteful, what one does is one exercises one's freedom even in the face of one's own personal advantage. The idea is that freedom is supposed to be a means. Freedom is a means to happiness by choosing what is to our own benefit. And what the Dostoevsky character tells us is it's the very opposite, that freedom, in fact, is something which is a good in its own right, it is the most important benefit that we have, and to sacrifice it by way of joining the others and seeing ourselves in terms of this grand plan for the good society is to essentially render ourselves inhuman. Needless to say, this view renders the underground man all but impotent. When he has to make a simple decision, for example, he finds himself incapable of doing it because insofar as freedom is something that can be predicted, that means it's not freedom at all. So if you tell me that what I ought to choose is this which will make me happier, then according to the underground man, it seems that what I ought to choose is precisely the opposite. But of course, one can argue this in a number of different ways, and so we're not surprised when throughout the novelette, the character himself ends up being not only very unhappy and spiteful, but also ends up doing nothing. Very different picture is drawn for us in one of Dostoevsky's longer, more brilliant novels called The Idiot. Now, the idiot in this case is a character who is rather highborn, names Prince Myshkin. And the prince has all the traits of, as Dostoevsky himself tells us, the perfectly good man. And again, what he's attacking is a certain kind of enlightenment and traditional philosophical picture. And that is, if you have a person who is perfect, or even a person who is very good, this will contribute to the well-being of society. It was an assumption that Aristotle made 2,500 years ago. It is, of course, built into the idea of Christianity that Jesus is a figure to be emulated, and it's because of Jesus, and here just Jesus as a moral example, that we all know what society should look like. It's certainly key to the Enlightenment that what we try to do is develop character and develop rules such that we all get along together. What's fascinating about the idiot is that by doing good, he makes everyone's life terrible. He's surrounded by suicides, broken marriages. People are in many different ways rendered unhappy because the truth is we don't know what to do with goodness. And of course, the idea is that the consequences of goodness are not always good themselves. One can think of this as a kind of defense, for example, of Immanuel Kant's philosophy, where he says it's really the intention that counts and not the consequences. And of course, this goes all the way back through the Judeo-Christian tradition, where again, it's intention, a goodwill that's at stake, not necessarily what follows from our actions, which is often not up to us. And taken as such, it's a rather extreme example of how we can still say that Prince Myshkin is the perfectly good man, even if what he causes in his life is utter disaster. Brothers Karamazov is, I think, Dostoevsky's crowning achievement. And in it, he discusses, among other things, the whole question of nihilism, a concept that, of course, is very central to Nietzsche. And as with Nietzsche, we should not think of Dostoevsky in any way as favoring it, but rather as being rabidly against it. Nihilism, in fact, is a Russian term. It came from some earlier Russian authors. And Dostoevsky was fully aware, as Nietzsche was aware, that it was a force that was really overtaking Europe. But like Kierkegaard, Dostoevsky didn't see the answer to nihilism as simply a renewed celebration of life, but quite to the contrary. He saw it as a return to traditional Christianity, even through Christianity as a very difficult pursuit indeed. The Brothers Karamazov concerns a family, the Karamazov family. The father, Fyodor, is, what shall we say, a dirty old man. He drinks too much. He chases women. He has no religious sensibilities. He is basically a pig. And he gives this, among other things, to his oldest son, Mitya, or Dmitri, who also has his father's sensuality, but a bit, just a bit more conscience. The second son, who is really the focus of the book, is the brother Ivan. And Ivan has been educated, well educated in the West, and he has adopted pretty thoroughly the Enlightenment philosophy, which Dostoevsky sees here as largely atheistic, as overly rationalistic, and consequently as nihilistic as well. And Ivan and Ivan's thought experiments really dominate a good part of the novel. The youngest son, Alyosha, is a sort of practicing novice saint. He, at the very beginning of the book, witnesses the death of his elder, his mentor, and is shocked to find out, for example, that when the elder saint dies, his body is corrupted like any other body. Alyosha has his own struggles with doubt through the novel, many of them fed by Brother Ivan. But between the three brothers, one sees the whole spectrum of sensuality on the one side to a kind of spirituality on the other, with Ivan caught in between with enlightenment thinking. There are two episodes in the book that I want to pay particular attention to, and in a way, they are sort of off the center stream of the story, because they're both stories that Ivan tells to Alyosha, and partly in order to express his own doubts about Christianity, but also to spur Alyosha's doubts as well. The first is a section called Rebellion, in which Ivan presents what we've already been introduced to as the problem of evil, and that is the idea, how can a perfectly good, all-powerful, all-knowing God allow so much suffering to take place on the earth? But Ivan's telling of it, we don't focus on the larger statistics, the sorts of overall calamities that some of the earlier philosophers had dwelt upon. But rather, he takes a rather horrible example of one Russian nobleman who dealt with a child who had essentially killed one of his dogs and had the dog set loose on the child, and the dogs, of course, ripped him apart. And the story is told in such bloody detail that, of course, anyone who reads it, Alyosha, who hears it, is shocked and repulsed. And then Ivan ends up by saying, how can we believe in a God that could justify any such event? And basically he says, if believing, accepting such an event, such a cruelty, is the price of believing in God, then personally, I don't want to pay the ticket. The second example is perhaps the most famous single section of the book. And it has to do with an even deeper doubt than the problem of evil. The idea is that Jesus essentially is our Savior, not just in the sense that we are, in some sense, relieved of our sins, but also he gives us a kind of freedom. The truth shall make you free. And that idea that freedom is essential to Christianity is something that Dostoevsky wants to throw seriously in question. Now, one way to read this is to look at it as a kind of internecine squabble between the two primary sects of Christianity, Catholicism on the one hand, Protestantism on the other. I think that's looking at it in a much too narrow fashion. I think it's really a dilemma of human life writ large that's being covered here, and it really has nothing necessarily to do with Christianity or Christianity and its sects particularly. The story, very briefly, is that the second coming actually happens. Jesus comes back to earth, and he happens to come back right in the middle of the Spanish Inquisition. The Grand Inquisitor, who is in charge of all of this, is stunned by Jesus' reappearance, but in a long dialogue with the Savior, comes up with the idea that Jesus really has to go. Because what Christianity has done over the past almost 2,000 years, 1,400 years, is it has succeeded in making people happy. They're happy at the hopes that it raises. They're happy at the idea of being saved. They're happy at the very idea of being in the shadow of Jesus, who has not yet appeared. But the fact is, with Jesus' appearance, people now have to face reality. And in fact, Christianity is not about freedom. It's not about happiness, or at least it can't be about both of those. And given the choice between freedom and happiness, people will always choose happiness. Or rather, the Grand Inquisitor chooses it for them. At the end of the story, Jesus is, in fact, re-crucified. And once again, what we find is that the easy interpretation of Christianity, the idea that freedom and happiness and faith can all fit together in a happy package, is just not the case. The same kind of gruesome picture is depicted for us in Dostoevsky's novel Crime and Punishment. The story is really very simple. A man commits a gruesome crime, essentially under the spell of nihilism. There are no values. There is nothing that is worth obeying. And although the crime itself is rather petty, also rather brutal, the character throughout the course of the novel finds himself haunted by a kind of deep guilt. And the story itself is the story of how this guilt manifests itself. It goes back to a line, perhaps the most famous single line, of Brothers Karamazov, where Ivan, as he is going insane towards the end of the novel, concludes that if there is no God, then everything is permitted. This is a slogan that is often used to interpret Nietzsche's philosophy, and I hope I've said enough about Nietzsche's philosophy to show that Nietzsche intended nothing of the sort. But rather, in Ivan, what we get is a picture of nihilism at its absolute worst. The idea that it's a world that entirely depended upon God for its values and on God for the authority for us to obey those values, and without God, we are left with simply nothing. Franz Kafka wrote primarily in this century. He was a Czech philosopher, author, and anyone who knows any of Kafka's short stories can quite quickly identify him as one of the primary authors of what Camus would later call the absurd. The concept, of course, appears in Kierkegaard almost a century before. But the idea of the absurd is taken to spectacular heights in Kafka's works. And I just want to talk about two of them here, both of which we've actually mentioned before. First of all, there is this short story, perhaps his best single work, called Metamorphosis. That's the one where Gregor Samsa wakes up in the morning and finds himself turned into a giant insect. Let's picture it as a cockroach, a particularly disgusting insect. Samsa is, in fact, a clerk, a perfectly ordinary person. He lives in a family, a perfectly ordinary family. He is a good family member. He is a good worker. And when he wakes up in this rather striking state, his first thoughts and the thoughts that pursue him throughout the first part of the text is simply the thought, how am I going to get to work today? It shows, in a sense, a very deep question about self-identity, because there's a sense in which we think of ourselves, body and soul, as inherently fused in an important way. And especially, we think of ourselves as very much depending upon who we are in terms of what we look like and what our abilities are. But what this story does is it sort of emphasizes in a way, a very Cartesian way of thinking about mind and body. Because in this story, the body is thoroughly changed in a way that most of us can't really imagine at all. But the mind remains exactly as it is. And what happens throughout the story is that Samsa has to cope with the idea, first of all, how he's going to get out of bed, then how he might get to work, and then, of course, main part of the story is he has to work with his rather horrible effect on his family. One can imagine waking up in the morning and finding one sibling or one son turned into an insect. Well, of course, it's a story with an unhappy ending. How else could it end? And one could interpret it as a kind of rehearsal of Kafka's own very difficult time with his family, and in particular with his father. But I think there's a more important theme here, and that is how our self-identity is construed, and in what sense it is construed, first of all, by our body, but that's not really the important issue, as much as how our self-identity is construed by our role in society and how other people treat us. So when he finds himself incapable of doing the job with which he identifies himself, when he finds himself horrifying his family, who come to despise him and hate him, that raises for Samsa a very real problem. And we're going to see it repeated when we talk about Heidegger and then Sartre. The other novel I want to talk about by Kafka is his novel called The Trial. I emphasized in my discussion of Camus and The Stranger that Kafka provided a sort of model for the trial that Camus stages for us, for Meursault. And the idea here, and the idea that pervades virtually all of Kafka's works, is the idea that we are all essentially guilty. And it doesn't have to do with any particular crime. In fact, there may be no crime at all. There's a sense in which just being human, just being conscious, makes us guilty. We're going to see this theme repeated in Kafka, who is going to say, in his own language, human beings are essentially guilty just by virtue of their existence. And what we find here, too, in The Trial, is the idea that that guilt pervades everything we do just by virtue of the fact that we are conscious. Here we can see a theme that is common to Kierkegaard, to Dostoevsky, and now to Kafka. Namely, the idea that consciousness, quite the contrary of being a blessing to us, can also be a disease. It allows us to see our life in a way that animals, for example, never see their lives. It allows us to be aware of good and evil in a way that animals never see values. It allows us to see ourselves as essentially inadequate creatures. And we don't simply accept ourselves unthinkingly as we are. But we are always self-conscious, and with that self-consciousness comes not only guilt, but a kind of despair. And all of Kafka's novels and short stories give us different ways of viewing and manifesting that despair. When we describe something as Kafkaesque, what we clearly have in mind is something that's not only absurd, but something that is very upsetting to our very notion of ourselves as human beings and our concept of life as it should be, in some sense rational, orderly, predictable. But that's exactly what it's not in both Metamorphoses and The Trial. Hermann Hesse was a Swiss writer. He was very well educated. In fact, we're now talking about a writer who worked in the mid-20th century. So he was already aware of Heidegger's philosophy, so I don't want to say that he influenced Heidegger so much as the other way around. But the main philosophical influences on him were two. The one of most importance to us here is Friedrich Nietzsche, because Nietzsche was someone Hesse read, and I think we can quite properly call him a follower. At the same time, he was influenced very powerfully by Buddhism. Now, Buddhism really doesn't play much of a role in Western thought, and that's something that's very curious in itself. It certainly has been known, at least in outline, by Westerners for a very long time. But the first philosopher to really talk about Buddhism and bring it into the core of his philosophy was Arthur Schopenhauer in the 19th century. And Hesse is one of the writers, one of the few writers, who also tries to bridge European and Indian thought. And he actually writes one full novel called Siddhartha, the Buddha's given name. And what he does is he there brings Buddha into a kind of Western picture, or a picture that Westerners can easily understand. But in terms of his admiration of Nietzsche, which is what I want to talk about, he takes on a number of different themes, and I'd like to talk about two of his works in which these themes become prominent. The first is a picture of a young man, a schoolboy in fact, named Demian. And of course, these days, Demian often represents a kind of satanic figure, and the idea is that he may even be the son of the devil. I'm thinking of a recent television episode. But basically, Demian is really just a very well-adjusted young man. So well-adjusted that he is independent in a way that children are not supposed to be independent. He has what Hesse refers to as the mark of Cain on him, but let's not talk about devilishness here so much as we should talk about something very different, a kind of independence, a kind of refusal to go along. And Demian's influence on his fellow classmates and friends is something which, far from being demonic, is always just the kind of puzzle, just the kind of challenge that philosophers in this tradition always like to talk about. More important, perhaps, is Hesse's depiction of a much older man. In fact, he is at the rather precise age of 55. This is the novel Steppenwolf, in which the central metaphor is this character, Harry Holler, who is half man and half wolf. That's important because it was a metaphor which was used most importantly by Goethe several generations earlier. And Goethe talks about man as half human, rational, sensitive, cultivated, and half wild beast. One of the challenges that Hesse wants to bring is just to this very bifurcated notion of the self, but not in terms of a unification of the self, something which Nietzsche, for example, praises Goethe for achieving, but rather a further fragmentation of the self, and in fact giving up the notion of a self altogether. The Steppenwolf concerns this character Haller, who has vowed to commit suicide when he reaches 55, because that's old enough. He is in every way a Nietzschean man. He considers himself one of the masters, not in any brutal way. He is, in fact, a very polite, well-behaved, good citizen. But he considers himself one of the masters in the sense that he is just so brilliantly educated. He is extremely creative. He is just the kind of character that Nietzsche himself aspired to be, and just the kind of character that Nietzsche represents in his discussion of the higher man. Like Kafka, Hesse challenges the very idea of Nietzsche's self, the idea of aspiration, the idea of taking life in Brunt so seriously. So, the Steppenwolf has the thesis that what Haller is mistaken in is precisely his conception of himself as half and half, man and wolf. Instead, borrowing from Buddhist philosophy, Hesse wants to say, in fact, Haller has no self, or many selves. And he illustrates this in what is the most delightful part of what otherwise is a rather serious and sometimes somber novel, called The Magic Theater, in which Haller is invited into this place, where, among other things, all of his values are turned upside down. Part of his extremely good taste, for example, as a good citizen of Europe at the beginning of the 20th century, was that he loved classical music and had no time at all for popular music, jazz in particular. So, of course, the first person he meets when he goes into the Magic Theater is a quite accomplished jazz musician who teaches him how to appreciate this really, in a sense, vulgar kind of music. Most importantly, what he finds is that the values are turned upside down. So in the Magic Theater, murder is permissible, not necessarily desirable, but permissible. And most importantly, when he enters the Magic Theater, he learns of the following story of the self. We think of the self, in the West especially, as a kind of a fruit, and let's say a peach in particular. Namely, there's a lot of flesh around it, where the flesh can be construed not only in terms of physical flesh, but also in terms of the culturations of society, the accumulations of one's education, what one has become as a member of this or that particular culture. But if you peel off the flesh, what you're left with is a kind of rock-hard pit, the self. In contrast to that, what we get in Steppenwolf is the very Eastern idea of the self as an onion. If you peel off the outer layers of an onion, what do you find? More layers. As you peel off more and more those inner layers, you find nothing but more layers. And when you finally peel off the last layers in the onion, you're left with nothing. It's a very wonderful Buddhist picture, and it's one that the Steppenwolf, Haller, is encouraged to accept, because in accepting it, what he can also accept is a kind of joy, a kind of happiness, which he has not learned hitherto. If you think about Nietzsche's story and how Nietzsche talks about aspiration and the Übermensch and self-discipline, all of this is admirable and enormously influential and persuasive. But for all of Nietzsche's attempts at humor, and he has a very subtle sense of humor, something's obviously missing, and that is humor, joy, happiness. Nietzsche talks about these things, but we're never convinced. With Hesse and his Buddhist orientation, we suddenly become convinced that one can start with something very much like Nietzsche, but nevertheless come out on the other end with a genuine joy of life that Nietzsche himself only talks about.